Hello, listener of the Third Sector podcast. This is Lucinda, and I thought you might be wondering what this unusual piece of content is on the Third Sector feed. In addition to our weekly show, we've just launched The End of Charity. It's a six-part documentary in which we ask whether the current charity model is fit for purpose and explore what the future might hold for the sector. It features some of the leading voices from the charity world, as well as radical thinkers who believe there's a need to disrupt the status quo. This is the first episode in the series. There's five more to come, and if you'd like to hear more, you can search for The End of Charity and subscribe or follow to be the first to know when we release new episodes. I hope you enjoy it.
The scale of the need from those early days when there were few food banks around the country to the scale that we're seeing now is just light and dark. We probably were providing 10 years ago 50,000, 60,000 emergency food parcels, whereas last year food banks in our network provided just under 3 million emergency food parcels, 1 million of which were for children.
We're at a food bank warehouse in Hackney in East London. It's early afternoon, and a small group of volunteers are unpacking wholesale boxes of goods and distributing them into individual piles. A packet of cereal, a jar of peanut butter, canned vegetables, pasta, instant coffee, and a single toilet roll are added to each pile. These goods will be given to members of the local community who don't have the money to buy them. People come to a nearby food bank centre with a voucher code and leave with a three-day supply of food and other essential items. This is emergency food aid, and it's being distributed daily in one of the wealthiest cities in the world. The warehouse in Hackney is one small part of a massive operation that supplies some 1,300 food banks across the UK. And it's run by a charity called the Trussell Trust.
I'm Emma Reevey, and I'm the chief executive of the Trussell Trust. The Trussell Trust was set up in 1997, actually, to work with young people who were living in a train station in Bulgaria, supporting them into employment and housing. And the founders, Paddy and Carol, received a telephone call from somebody who lived where they were from in Salisbury. And they said, look, we'd love to support your work overseas, but we can't afford to. I can't even afford to feed my own children. And that triggered in Paddy a desire to find out more about the poverty in his own community and led to the establishment of the first food bank in his garden shed, providing 3 days of emergency food to people in Salisbury.
Today, the Trussell Trust's mission is simple but ambitious: to stop hunger and poverty in the UK. The Trussell Trust is just one tiny part of the UK charity sector. More than 200,000 charities are registered in Britain. Some are tiny voluntary outfits run by a single person, while others are multi-million pound institutions that could easily be mistaken for big corporations. And charity has been around for a long, long time. There is some evidence of charity in the ancient world, some 4,500 years ago. Turns out humanity has always liked to help. And what's more, charities exist in almost all walks of life. They provide vital services, raise awareness and campaign for social change, fund medical research, and give out grants to support causes that range from animal welfare to human rights, education, environmental protection, and end-of-life care. Many have been in operation for hundreds of years, while some, like the Trussell Trust, are relative newcomers which have seen exponential growth in the very recent past. So charity is a part of the fabric of our society, but is it really a solution to the many societal, ecological, and existential problems we face today? Or are there better ways of tackling the world's problems? Ones that don't involve charity at all?
You know, if you come to a crunch of giving charity a fiver or giving one of my kids a fiver, I will give my kids. They don't help that many people.
Last year, 780,000 people came for the first time to our food banks. We're going to do everything we can for as long as we can to support people.
I'm Lucinda Rouse. I'm a journalist at Third Sector magazine, and this is The End of Charity. In this series, I'm going to be exploring whether the traditional concept of charity as we know it has had its day. If you think about charity at all, it might just be in terms of the monthly donation you make, the marathon you signed up to run, or the peppering of charity shops on our high streets. But the origin story of charity goes way back into the Middle Ages. St John Ambulance, the UK's leading first aid charity, was founded in Jerusalem in 1113 during the Crusades. The City Bridge Foundation is one of the UK's wealthiest charities. Today, it has a portfolio value of more than £838 million, and it dates back even further, thanks to the levy of a special tax to help repair London Bridge, made of wood back then, in 1097. It was around the 1500s when new religious ideas about philanthropy and making charitable donations began to take hold, and the Victorian era when Britain saw an explosion of charitable activity. So it's been around for a fair old while.
The idea of caritas, which is where the word charity comes from, is a very old one. It goes back a couple of thousand years. And it's essentially about sort of individual care, and it was tied in very much to religious views about almsgiving and that kind of thing.
This is Rodri Davis. He's a philanthropy expert, a connoisseur of charity.
I guess the point that's really important thinking about charity as it is now in the UK is probably the Victorian era, because that's where we have the model of charity as a way of the haves, essentially, giving to the have-nots. And the bit of that that I think is really important that, and has unfortunately stuck with us, is a focus on needing to discriminate between the people who are deserving of your charity and the ones who are not deserving. We still see this very much in terms of views about poverty and who should or shouldn't be the recipients of charity. And I think putting that sort of power in the hands of the donor, that's problematic, because I think that power imbalance is something that we're still seeing as an issue in the sector today.
Rodri raises some important points around the relationship between charities, their donors, and the people they exist to help. And the problem of who holds power in this relationship is a big issue that the sector is grappling with. But the idea of the wealthy giving to the less fortunate is a long-standing pillar of how a charity works. And whatever your views on the charity model, there's no denying that the current scale of demand for charity services is pushing the sector to the brink. Here at Third Sector, we've reported on more charity closures in the past 6 months than in at least as many years. Organisations have been hit first by the government's austerity measures, then the economic effects of the COVID pandemic, and now the cost of living crisis. And as those charities have closed, the people they existed for are left with one less avenue to go down to access the help they need. This is our world. We report on it every day. But what does charity mean in the eyes of the general public, many of whom form the wide network of donors that keep charities running? I took to the streets of London to find out.
I definitely think they have a role to play in society, where governments or private entities are maybe not as inclined to do charitable work or to help less fortunate people.
And also, for people who do volunteer in charities, they do it for altruistic reasons as well. So it's good for them. It makes them feel good.
They'd do anything, really.
Why do you say that?
Because I just go around poncing. Charity begins at home. That's my attitude. Because there's enough of our own people who need... They need us, like our own kids. You know, if you come to a crunch of giving charity a fiver or giving one of my kids a fiver, I will give my kids. They don't help that many people. Because, I mean, I know for a fact a lot of the times with charities, they take so much money out of it.
This tiny sample of the public is more or less consistent with the wider population. Last year, the Charity Commission for England and Wales, that's the charity regulator, asked more than 4,000 people what they thought of charities, and they found that the public are largely supportive. But people do want to see more transparency from them, particularly on where funds are spent. Charities are more trusted than banks, politicians, and the police, and people feel a lot more positive about charities than they did 5 years ago. It's been a slow, steady improvement since 2015, when confidence hit rock bottom. the sector suffered a series of high-profile cases involving bad governance at some very well-known charities, which caused a lot of damage. And it's these larger charities that still seem to have a trust problem. People are much less likely to trust big, multi-million pound charities than the smaller local organisations. And a lot of it comes down to money. People really care about where and how their donations are spent. So charities need to work hard not to be labelled as poorly managed or ineffective, as well as everything else they have to handle. And today, charities are working harder than ever. Emma Reevy from the Trussell Trust.
How does it make you feel seeing the extent to which your operations have grown to meet that rising demand?
It's really devastating. When I speak to our food bank managers, they tell me so often how insufficient a food parcel feels to the needs that people are telling them about. It's just not enough. If somebody isn't able to afford food, they're likely not able to afford to keep their homes warm, to pay for travel to school or to essential appointments, to pay for new school shoes or school uniform. A parcel just feels insufficient. And so to see more and more people having to come to food banks, last year 780,000 people came for the first time to our food banks. That number of people coming to us and feeling the insufficiency of the response. We're going to do everything we can for as long as we can to support people. But it's not right that anyone is having to turn to a charity for something as essential as food. So it feels heavy and really worrisome.
When you listen to Emma describe that sense of inadequacy and the sheer number of issues that contribute to poverty, you have to wonder whether a charity like the Trussell Trust, for all the fantastic work that it does, is really best placed to tackle them. But as Rodri explains, charities often approach these problems from different levels.
I often think of it in terms of sort of upstream and downstream, so a kind of spectrum. The downstream end, what I mean by that is, that's where you're essentially doing what maybe people traditionally think of as the work of charities, which is directly addressing needs. So, you know, running a food bank or a soup kitchen and literally helping individual people who just need something very basic. And then at the upstream end, it's kind of doing things like research and advocacy that's designed to try and address the fundamental problems, you know, why you need food banks in the first place. So, and a lot of organizations, I think charities individually try and do both, but certainly I think there's room within the charity sector as a whole for all of those different approaches. So I think, you know, you will have food banks, for instance, providing people with the food that they need right here and now, but it's really important that we don't see that as, you know, that's job done and nothing more needs addressing. Actually, what we need at the same time is to say, well, why is it that we as a society are in a position where people, you know, children and families need other people to provide food for them on a charitable basis? Something is fundamentally broken. Let's understand what that is and let's campaign for the necessary changes to the way that politics and society works to make sure it doesn't happen in the future. And I think, you know, kind of along that spectrum, there are, you know, all sorts of different things that charities can do, some of which directly address needs and some of them which try to kind of get at the underlying causes. And I think they're always trying to balance those two things.
As well as providing emergency food parcels, the Trussell Trust has stepped into that upstream role by collecting data about its food bank users and making sure that that evidence lands on the desks of the right people. Here's Emma again.
So it's really important to us to understand who is coming to food banks and why, because our vision is for a UK without the need for food banks. So we want to understand what is causing people to have to turn to food banks so as we can try and tackle those root causes. And so we know that there are certain groups of people that are significantly overrepresented at food banks. For example, 68% of people coming to food banks have a disability or come from a household where somebody has a disability. So we know that disability responsibility, but also caring responsibilities, are a huge driver of why somebody might not be able to afford the essentials. We also know that certain groups have increased barriers to work and challenges, which can also lead to them having to turn to a food bank. We know groups like the LGBTQ plus community, minority ethnic groups of people are overrepresented at food banks. And the structural reasons why that is are things that we need to be tackling if we really want to see an end to the need for food banks. And the biggest single driver of food bank use is the insufficiency of social security. So the design and deliverability of social security is causing people simply just not to have enough money for the essentials.
Now, social security is a term that gets used a lot, but how many people actually understand what it really means? I asked Emma to explain what it is in the simplest possible terms.
So when I speak about social security, I mean working age benefits that we provide to people if we lose our jobs, if we're unwell and unable to work, if we have a disability that prevents us working at all. We as a society have determined that there will be social security in place. At the moment, you'll hear people talking about universal credit, which is the main source of social security at the moment. And when we talk about social security being insufficient, we're saying the levels at which universal credit and other social security benefits are paid at are just too low for people to be able to afford the essentials.
In other words, the need for food banks has soared because provision is lacking for people who, for whatever reason, can't earn enough money to support themselves. The Trussell Trust has the data to back this up. But interestingly, as we'll hear in a later episode, many of the groups that are overrepresented at food banks are underserved by the wider charity sector. So what do we do with that information? Emma believes it's time for some collective introspection.
When you're seeing this scale of need and this scale of response, you have to question, what is going on here? What do we want for our society? What is our social contract with one another? Do we believe it's okay that so many families are finding themselves without enough money to buy food? Our latest research showed that half of working age families on universal credit last month were running out of money to afford food by the end of the month. Is that what we want for our society? Is the response we want to make in that situation an emergency food parcel? Or do we want something better? And for us, the change we want to see is everyone being able to afford the essentials.
But who should be responsible for that change? The Trussell Trust is lobbying the government to take the lead. And according to Emma, they are making headway. But one thing's clear, Emma does not want the Trussell Trust to become a permanent fixture.
For many charities, it's going to be really important for the fabric of our society that those charities be here for a long, long time to come. We don't view ourselves in that way. We don't view ourselves as one of those charities you would want to have going on forever and ever. We would love the idea of what could happen if the 40,000 volunteers at the moment who are gathering food and providing food and creating those spaces for people to come and access that support, we're doing something else within civil society, providing other support, because we no longer mass distributed emergency food aid. That's an exciting concept for us. But I think we don't think of ourselves in those terms, in terms of part of the ongoing fabric of society, but rather a temporary structure that we would seek to dismantle at the first available moment.
But for now, charities like the Trussell Trust do exist. And let's be absolutely clear, these charities are a lifeline to millions of people. But if we think about Emma's question of social contract, what would the world look like if we could solve problems like poverty and hunger without charities? Here's Rodri again.
I think there are some. I mean, some of them will come from outside of the charity sector as we know it now. And I think the fact that there's a much wider range of options for people when it comes to wanting to do good in the world with their time and their money means that, you know, charities can't assume that they're the only game in town anymore. There are all of these other options, whether that's mutual aid networks, whether it's kind of digital social movements, whether it's businesses increasingly sort of saying that they've got a social purpose. And if you, you know, shop with us or work with us, you'll be doing good in the world as well as potentially kind of making money or getting products. That wider range of options means that people may want to look elsewhere if they don't feel that charities are the best way of kind of achieving what they want to achieve in the world.
But what are these other options disrupting the charity sector? Well, one of them, you or perhaps the young people in your life may well know of.
Nearly half the population with curable blindness doesn't have access to this surgery, so I wanted to provide this to as many people as possible.
Can a YouTuber fix the world?
In this video, we're curing 1,000 people's blindness. It's gonna be crazy.
If you look at the amount of money that is spent every year by the US government and by the massive charitable foundations and everything, it's not enough to go around. It's never gonna be enough.
Join us for the next episode of The End of Charity, where we'll be digging into the online phenomenon that is Mr. Beast. The End of Charity is brought to you by Third Sector, the UK's leading title for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector. It was written and presented by me, Lucinda Rouse, and edited by Emily Burt. The producers were Ollie Peart and Penny Bell at Rethink Audio. And special thanks to Rebecca Cooney, who devised the original concept for the series.